Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you so much for tuning in on a Tuesday morning. And this is your host for Speak Up, Pranjali Mann. And I am joined today by a very lovely guest with me who will be shortly introducing. And before we do that, I just wanted to tell you that we will be doing some interview style questions, but that will be also followed by some music that Adriana, who is the guest for today, will be sharing with us. So sorry for putting you on the spot, but let's get started. So hi, Adriana, and please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hey, thanks for having me. My name is Adriana Cumming Teicher. I use she, they pronouns. I'm a communications major. I'm going into my fifth year. I do a lot of policy work. I advocate for disabled and queer students on campus. I liaise with various nonprofits. I help advocate alongside the SFSS to the university directly and do a lot of that fun kind of work.
Mm-hmm. And also, side note, we were in a class together, so it was so much fun to have met you through that class and also know about and hear about the great work that you have been doing with the community. Mm-hmm. So what does even community mean to you, and what sort of work have you been involved in?
Yeah, I think community holds a lot of different definitions, but I think one that drives my work and a lot of the sort of experiences that I've had is a level of shared experience and shared lived reality that enables people to connect and realize human relationships and realize like community practices of care on a level that's deeper than what people who are just strangers might experience. Like if I'm talking to someone else who is also trans or also disabled or otherwise queer, there's a level of base understanding where I can know that certain lived experiences that I'm having are shared or at least understood. And so when we're talking about community and especially how that filters through my work, that background of community allows me to come from a place of shared interest and shared need. And operating from that place allows for sharper political and advocacy goals.
Amazing. And also, I'm aware of the fact that you're part of the Out on Campus group. So what is Out on Campus and what sort of your role entails in there?
Yeah, so Out on Campus is the resident queer group on campus. We have a lounge space in the Student Union building on the second floor by the elevators. We run events. We do some level of political advocacy. Our staff coordinator, Jude Ma, does case management with various students, helping them access like gender affirming care, binders, other like forms of necessary, other forms of support that they require, be it around like housing or specific advocacy. But overall, it's really just an atmosphere that allows for broader community and allows for people to feel seen and make friends and be present in this space. So we've got our staff coordinator who runs the space, goes to all the meetings, overall directs the sort of trajectory of Out on Campus. We've got our staff assistant who does our outreach, manages the Discord community space, etc. And then we've got our student collective, which ultimately offer the like core direction that Out on Campus is going, as well as add our own manpower and decision making to points of advocacy, event management, and so on.
There were so many interesting points and themes, I think, in the kind of work that you do. But just I think outside of my communications bubble, I have not heard people talk much about what does it mean to be seen as a queer person, or what does it mean to be seen even. So if you could like talk more about how things are going and how do you contextualize, or how would you explain what being seen as would be?
I mean, I think when we're talking queer identity, and especially certain queer identities, there's a lot of the notion of invisibility, and specifically the notion of being invisibilized by spaces and structures around you. That in spaces where, in a sort of liberal notion, queerness is often, though this is backsliding even to this front, but in very liberal spaces seen as a sort of acceptable and private notion, that the open like harassment and bigotry towards queer people is unacceptable, but that queer culture and queer community and queer existence as loud and proud is not worthy of celebration and is not worthy of acceptance in the public sphere. And that there's this expectation that queerness is allowed to exist, but that queerness is something that can only exist within the self and not within the public. And I think a lot of queer spaces are sort of inherently revolutionary one. It's this idea that our existence and our joy is a fundamental act of violence against the system, that because the status quo is so aligned directly against our ability to organize and exist in spaces together, that just the act of our community and our love and our, as I mentioned before, joy is inherently sort of destructive towards the status quo. And so when we're talking about feeling seen and contextualizing that within the kind of myopic idea of self, I think it's this idea that those spaces can only exist when coming from a place of mutual understanding. A straight cis person is limited in their ability to sort of feel a deep well of understanding and selfhood in the context of these spaces. And that level of understanding is necessary for our survival. I mean, even when queerness was outlawed and actively criminalized, what was always true is that queer people found each other and stuck together and formed these practices of care amongst each other. And I think it's also important to sort of tie in ideas of community practices of care, which I've mentioned a couple times, and talk about the ways that queer communities have operated as collective bodies to raise each other up and to provide where systems don't. This idea that monetary resources and emotional bandwidth and like addiction support and all of these things are things that take a village, and things that when collectivized on a broader level in a community, everyone is able to survive and thrive in a way that is much more deeply meaningful than individually accessing neoliberal forms of support and advocacy within the system.
So when you talk about like, thank you so much for those responses, first of all. But like in terms of having those advocacy systems, what do you think is the role of an ally, or like people who might not identify as those but like want to help out, want to form a community, want to support that community? What sort of things can they do?
I mean, fight legislatively is the big one, but one that's top of mind for me right now with the sort of like ongoing culture wars and the sort of Western world, to put it sort of vaguely, is as you're going about advocating for our rights and our access to public spaces and our rights to our health care and our education and our ability to participate in team settings and enjoy public life to the same degree that cishet people are as ourselves, I think is to focus on what's important and the real fights that have to be had. Fight against anti-bathroom bills that are preventing us from accessing bathrooms that are aligning with our affirmed gender. Fight anti-sports bills that are talking about preventing specifically trans women from accessing women's sports, even though all major scientific bodies are agreed that after a certain amount of HRT, there is no broader physiological difference that is notable on a competitive athletic level. Fight against gender-affirming care bans. These forms of care are almost always existingly prohibited from children anyway. So these bans only serve to disincentivize adult trans people from making medically informed decisions, rather than the culture war bullshit. Like, a bunch of TERFs on Twitter are talking about the term bonus hole, which is a term I don't think I've heard a trans person use, and pretending that these are sites of real discourse, even from a pro-trans perspective, even being like, trans people have a right to use the term bonus hole. It's like, sure. All right. But to some degree, we need allies to fight with us where it matters and not allow those who wish to strip us of our rights to move the conversation to whatever inane bullshit they want it to be.
I can't agree more. Like, yes, absolutely. Like, word to word, I think I know where it's heading, I guess, but like, very true for sure. Also in terms of like, because inherently we are students right now, and we are part of different student unions. We go to classes. We are part of this institution, which has been, white supremacist for very long, mm-hmm. and has been producing scholars and work that is just very specific to whites and cisgenders. How do you think with a shift in institutions like the education system or the healthcare system, for example, but we'll just stick to education for now, how do you think do these spaces change or need to change?
I mean, I think the way, even if it's sort of framed as this very simplistic and incomplete sort of solution, I think just a level of representation matters. Like, obviously, one person of color and one queer person and one disabled person in a broadly systemically harmful institution is not going to fix anything. But what you will start seeing is that those voices start existing in these spaces, and those voices gain influence, and those voices get to make more voices. Like, I'll use an example from my wonderful mentor, Dr. Victoria Thomas, who is a Black woman from the States, who, in talking about her own scholarship and her own approach to what it means to sort of operate within these institutions and fight against the notion of what is being systematized. She does a lot of trans feminist scholarship, and she was talking about that she's very open when applying for positions, that her sole intention is to take the money that is offered through grants and give it to trans people. And she doesn't understand why they keep hiring her, but they do. So she takes the money and she gives it to trans people. I mean, she's hiring me at the start of next year to do research with her, along with many other trans scholars throughout both her past, present, and future work. And even just that is a change. And as much as I do hold, like, deeply progressive sort of notions of what needs to be done, I'm not a revolutionary. I think that this sort of work can be achieved through these slow reformist notions. And on Dr. Thomas's example, she's helping my ability to become a scholar. And then when I become a scholar, I have every intention to do the same. And Dr. Thomas isn't just helping me. There's other scholars that she's sponsoring and helping navigate these spaces and become entrenched in this field. And slowly, those processes will grow. Because as much as the system is so geared towards white, cis-heteronormative, able-bodied scholars through the idea of legacy admissions, if we start allowing there to be minority scholars in these positions, those legacy positions and those legacy forms of advocacy will start to filter down and will start to improve. Now, I do think that this is a fundamentally incomplete approach, because just having these voices in these spaces doesn't mean that these voices will be listened to. But I do think it's an important first step, and I don't think that we're meaningfully beyond a point where that first step can be ignored. However, we are going to talk beyond that first point. I think we fundamentally need to start operating from a place that is non-hierarchical and non-seniority-based, because as is widely known, these institutions have been run by white people because they were built by white people to subjugate non-white people. So if we're talking about the idea of seniority, white people will have always come before in how we're describing these things. They're operating from fundamentally colonial premises. So in order for these voices to actually be listened to, the idea of seniority and hierarchy within academic institutions has to be done away with. If you're a scholar, just because you've been a scholar for 2 years or 10 doesn't make you a scholar that's more proficient or somehow superior. It's not like we have fucking EXP levels. We're not in a MMO version of reality. Of course, there is experiences that come with scholarship, but there's also benefits and real lived experience to be gained from being a young or new scholar. Perspectives that are new and fresh and not less than more experienced and specifically tenured scholars. There's ideas of labor practices that differ and points of advocacy that are fundamentally different between associate, tenure, and tenure track professors that do not operate on such clean lines of one is better than the other, better than the other. So I think if we are meaningfully to reform the way that education works from these like hyper-colonial practices, I think this idea of hierarchy needs to be fundamentally disintegrated. And I don't think that what that should look like is, all the tenured professors should lose their jobs and we should replace them all. No, I think that the same benefits that tenured professors see, the same access to security and wages and support in their positions, should be extended to professors that are newer or in more precarious job positions. It's not about trying to claw everyone down to one level. It's about raising everyone up and seeing this equality of outcome. Because that's such a controversial idea, equality of outcome. But why is it a controversial idea? Because it's clear that it's not an idea of, well, people should earn it, because this is well studied and well documented that sort of skewed idea of outcome is not a result of merit. Many people work harder and are dying because they're starving than people who are very comfortably wealthy. So there's no idea of meritocracy. It's solely a sort of vague, myopic idea of wanting to keep others below you. And I fundamentally disagree with that notion. So I think in order for education to be meaningfully reformed, I think that that idea of equality of outcome is important. That if you're putting in the work and you're doing the work of an academic, you should be treated with the respect and the security that academics who are above you in this sort of colonial system are.
Yeah, for sure. I think the point of representation that you started off with is so important to think also in terms of that representation, maybe in hiring or maybe in giving a professor tenure or not, should not be dependent on just this idea, as you mentioned, about how long you have been in this career, how many things you have done, because obviously these guys who have been here for long, who have got the access to these spaces from the day they are born in a family, it's going to be very different. But the other thing that we need to keep in mind is that the representation should not come out as a product of tokenizing certain people, that there should be a person from this group, from this community. So the tokenizing aspect of it should be definitely taken into account, and representation should not just become like a symbol, just a token of these institutions. And we'll continue our conversations. We'll just have like a brief song break in here. And I think a song that is very relevant that just comes to my mind right now if you guys have been hearing to my episodes, I think you know probably that I like Taylor Swift's music a lot. So just one music for today from her. So I will be playing The Man by Taylor Swift right now, and then we'll continue our conversations.
I would be complex. I would be cool. They'd say I played the field before I found someone to commit to. And that would be okay for me to do. Every conquest I had made would make me more of a boss to you.
I'd be a fearless leader. I'd be an alpha type. When everyone believes ya, what's that like? I'm so sick of running as fast as I can, wondering if I'd get there quicker if I was a man. And I'm so sick of them coming at me again, 'cause if I was a man, in the work, they wouldn't shake their heads and question how much of this I deserve, what I was wearing, if I was rude, could I be separated from my good ideas and power moves? And they would toast to me, or let the players play. I'd be just like Leo in Saint-Tropez. I'm so sick of running as fast as I can, get there quicker if I was a man. And I'm so sick of them coming at me again, 'cause if I was a man, then I'd be the man. I'd be the man. I'd be the man. What's it like to brag about raking in dollars and getting bitches and models? And it's all good if you're bad, and it's okay if you're mad. If I was out flashing my dollars, I'd be a bitch, not a father. They paint me out to be bad, so it's okay that I'm mad. I'm so sick of running as fast as I can, wondering if I'd get there quicker if I was a man. You know that. And I'm so sick of them coming at me again.
So you guys were listening to The Man by Taylor Swift. And just picking off our conversations where we left 2-3 minutes ago, I think it's good to dive deeper into and like sort of explain the different layers that come in with something that we might qualify as or call as student advocacy. So what does it imply for you? And I know I also do some sort of advocacy or activism work, but over to you, Adriana, and then we can like have a conversation about what does it even mean being part of these groups and standing up for these groups, but also being students and learning about these different things. So being informed by these institutions and having to stand against these institutions.
I think the best way to describe it, or at least how I personally see it, is it's operating as a shield for the student body. Our labor is necessary to protect students from a lot of the university's actions, which seek to disenfranchise or harm them at every turn. I mean, it's only just this past month that SFU wanted to issue 6% budget cuts to student services, and they're in the process of negotiations because student services couldn't cut 6% without firing people and services going dark. I mean, it was less than a year ago that SFU completely axed High Five, their like acclaimed mental health group that they started. So I view student advocacy as a sort of shield, as I mentioned, that our labor is necessary to guard the student body, that without the constant droning pressure that we provide, the university would feel empowered to make whatever cuts and changes it wanted to fuel into the bonuses of the like 10 executives who sit up top. That's a very cynical perspective on student advocacy, of course. But I say more broadly, I view it as a way to sort of give back in sort of the ways that I've been supported in my life. That, like, I mean, I was a disabled student growing up. I have ADHD. I struggle with many things. I also have a writing disability around handwriting. And my mom was my champion during all of that time and managed to get me IEPs and access to certain accessibility equipment in schools and advocated directly to my professors and teachers who would discriminate against me. And at the point in my life that I'm at now, where I'm able to self-advocate and access these kinds of supports and institutional access to accommodations and things in my own life, that I want to give back on a sort of broader societal and especially a student level, where I can sort of take the advocacy that has been given to me throughout my life by, again, my mother, but lots of other people throughout my life who have assisted me and helped me get to the point where I'm at now, and offer that same kind of, like, outstretched hand of support to every student who needs it. Every student who's got a deferred grade they're failing, or a professor who refuses to honor their accommodation needs, or is 1,000 miles away from a family who won't accept them for who they are, so they're still hiding from that reality. To offer a hand to those students and say, hey, I see you, I'll help you, and I'll help fight for you. Tell me what you need, and I'll be there. So, yeah, that's how I would kind of say I approach student advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. I think before, like, because I talk about my work a lot on radio and just a side note and self-promotion here, I do, like, a hour show which talks about my sort of research endeavors and how it relates to what I'm doing with, or I hope to kind of connect with the community. So I think I'll not take too much space here today to talk about it. But I think the response that you just gave, Adriana, in terms of having those support systems, having those people around you, that is really, really, really important. And I have seen that in my life as well. Having that core group of people who are always there for you, who are always, like, standing for you, is very important, especially when you are trying to do something that is understood as unprecedented, or something that is understood as not very normal. So what would you say, or what would you think is the best way to get started for someone who might not be doing all these sort of works and might be just very confused and, like, where should I just begin? Mm-hmm.
I think there's levels of entry points. I don't think there's one prescribed fix, and I don't think there's one way to approach it. So I'm gonna kind of go in ascending intensity. I think just being a volunteer with a group on campus, especially the constituency groups who advocate for certain marginalized identities of people on campus, which can include female-identifying people, queer students, Black students, Indigenous students, and disabled students. Those are our 5 constituency groups on campus. And just being in the space, making it a community environment. If we have events, you know, being a pair of hands and just helping grow the community and being involved in a low level that is mostly about you getting to enjoy the space and the community and the services, but is allowing more people to feel welcome. I think that's an incredibly valid and incredibly meaningful way to be involved. So if you're interested in, like, looking at what that looks like, the staff coordinators that are in those spaces all day will happily help talk through what that would look like for you at your level of sort of engagement. If you want to get a little bit more involved in a more assistive capacity, but still want to keep things at a sort of, like, individualized level where you're wanting to feel like you're doing something good, offer support, and have a good time, I recommend joining the collective/executive for one of these groups or another advocacy group on campus that looks like talking to the students involved or the staff coordinators. If there's around an election period running, but these are usually unopposed positions. We're not huge groups ever. Getting added as an exec or collective member mid-term. And in terms of what that looks like from day to day, it looks like showing up to biweekly meetings, helping brainstorm events, talking about policy goals, and being part of what goes into guiding that space. It's mostly just a very like low-key, friend-centered group, because most of what you're doing is meeting with people in your community that you like hanging out with and